he's in charge, and it's really not looked warmly upon if other people encroach upon his territory.
Key takeaways from this week's meeting between President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping.
For Thursday, October 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, we've got advice for you if your regular doctor is suddenly no longer in your health insurance network.
We hadn't looked at our plan before to figure out that we would have to pay 100% out of pocket.
Also, our Planet Money team gets into the board game business because, come on, some of the best board games are all about the money.
And we visit a Halloween pop-up shop to find out what it's like to work there.
They're headed for the pop-up shop at one end of the parking lot.
Every day here is October 31st.
Those stories and much, much more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is back in Washington after his meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping in South Korea. The two leaders didn't reach a deal on trade issues, but NPR's Emily Fang reports some critical issues have been paused.
China's most devastating threat, a near total export ban on products containing rare earth materials the U.S. cannot make itself, has now been paused, and Xi Jinping agreed China will again buy U.S. soybeans. Despite fears that China would push the U.S. to say something on Taiwan, Trump said the topic never came up. China wants to control the Democratic Island that Beijing claims is theirs. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer weighed in on another heated point of contention, and that is China's desire to buy powerful NVIDIA semiconductor chips that are crucial to some artificial intelligence capabilities. Greer said it would need to be discussed later. Emily Fang, NPR News.
42 million people around the country are preparing to cope with the looming pause of Supplemental Nutritious Assistance Program, or SNAP, if the federal government shutdown doesn't end. Grant Blankenship of Georgia Public Broadcasting has more.
About 1 in 8 people in Georgia rely on SNAP. But so far, Governor Brian Kemp says he won't dip into the state's $14.6 billion budget surplus to help feed them during the shutdown. Meanwhile, food banks have been struggling with shortages since a $1 billion cut to USDA programs in March. Working mom Ashley Stevenson couldn't find any food at either of the two pantries she checked in the city of Macon.
We're looking at feeding 3 kids with barely anything after bills and everything else. Unfortunately, the government is not doing its job, and the people are being screwed because of it.
Stevenson says she doesn't know what her next move will be. For NPR News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon, Georgia.
Hurricane Melissa is approaching Bermuda as a Category 2 hurricane after causing more than 24 deaths and property damage across the Caribbean as one of the region's most powerful storms in the past century. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports climate change made the disaster about 4 times more likely.
Scientists at Imperial College in the United Kingdom study the role of climate change in individual weather events, like heat waves and hurricanes. To study Hurricane Melissa, they used computer models to compare what actually happened to what would have happened if the planet was the temperature it used to be back in the 1950s. Their findings indicate climate change made it 4 times more likely a Category 5 storm would make landfall in Jamaica. In other words, this disaster would have been much less likely without global warming. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. United Nations officials say it's difficult to estimate just how many civilians have been killed in El Fasher, a city in Sudan's Darfur region that fell to a brutal paramilitary force. The UN says there are credible reports of executions, including the killing of 500 people at a maternity ward, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Nowhere is safe in El Fasher. That was the message of one top UN official, Martha Poby, in her briefing to the Security Council. The UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator, Tom Fletcher, says this recalls the horrors of the genocide in Darfur 2 decades ago.
But what is different today is that we're seeing a different global reaction, one of resignation. So this is also a crisis of apathy.
The conflict is not just a civil war between Sudan's army and the Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary that took over El Fasher. The RSF gets support from the United Arab Emirates, and other regional players are backing the army. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
French authorities have arrested five more people over the Louvre crown jewel heist. That makes seven suspects total in custody. The jewels, however, haven't been found. The loot is estimated to be worth $102 million and includes a diamond and emerald necklace that Napoleon gave to Empress Marie Louise as a wedding gift. Only one relic has been found, Empress Eugenie's crown, which was dropped during the escape. Officials say it is damaged, but it's salvageable. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. on Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, the two most powerful men in the world came face-to-face at a South Korean airport. We're talking about President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping, their first meeting in 6 years. They talked tariffs, appeared to step back from the brink in what has amounted to Trump's economic war with China during his second term. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram has been traveling with the president. She's in South Korea today. Deepa joined me, along with NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, on our national security podcast, Sources and Methods. We talked through the summit, including the curveball that Trump delivered right before it got underway. On Truth Social, President Trump wrote, and I quote, "Because of other countries' testing programs, I have instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis." Deepa, I think I can sum up the collective reaction here in Washington as, wait, what? What was the reaction there in Asia?
It was sort of one of those things that went out and we were like, oh, very focused on a Trump-Xi summit. And then all of a sudden, you know, in a very Trump-esque way, this other thing like flies out of left field.
Did it come up in the actual summit?
It didn't. And it's sort of, or if it did, we don't know that they spoke about it. And to be honest, like, there hasn't really been much follow-up. Like, we don't really know a lot of detail. What does an instruction to the Department of War slash Defense look like? Where would testing take place? And what would Trump even want that to look like? So there's just, it's sort of one of those things that Trump fired off and we're sort of left asking a lot more questions.
Tom, any details from the Pentagon? Any reaction?
Well, first of all, the Pentagon doesn't do testing. It's done by a division of the Department of Energy called the National Nuclear Security Administration, number one. Number two is the testing site is in the Nevada desert. So even if you wanted to do testing, setting it up with diagnostic equipment and figuring out where you wanted to do it and what you wanted to do would take many months, I'm told, if not years.
So do we know why this was on President Trump's mind as he's walking into a big summit with Xi?
Well, we think it was precisely because Russia has tested these delivery systems. Again, not weapons, just how you would deliver a nuclear weapon. So everyone's speculating that's precisely why he's doing it, because of what Putin announced.
Okay, so let's go to what actually did get discussed at this summit and what we were expecting to be the big headlines, which have to do with trade, have to do with tariffs. Deepa, give us the very quick rundown on where they landed.
Yeah, I would say it comes down to like a big three on this, like the takeaways from this meeting. One is basically that China agreed to pull back on some of the limits they had put on rare earths exports. Mm-hmm. The other element was that China would resume buying soybeans from the U.S. immediately. And that's, of course, been a major issue for American farmers since China halted those shipments. And then the other thing is that Trump said, this is the big number part, that tariffs on China would be lowered from 57% to 47%. And that 10% drop, Trump says, is because Xi committed to decrease the flow of fentanyl coming into the U.S. That is the reason that Trump said he would lower the tariff.
Yeah. The captain basic question, have we figured out what U.S. policy on China is? What the
goal of all of the threats of tariffs and then walking back the threats of tariffs is?
It's a really good question. And based on a lot of people I've talked to, there isn't exactly an answer. I did talk to Ryan Haas, who's the director of the China Center at Brookings, and he said that Trump policy is really different than his first term. But he said in the second term, it's essentially kind of like this.
China policy is the president's policy. He drives, he's in charge, and it's really not looked warmly upon if other people encroach upon his territory without his guidance or direction on how to do so.
And think about how Trump does a lot of diplomacy, right? It's very personality oriented. It's very, you know, a lot of compliments, a lot of fanfare. And that is essentially how he's treated his relationship with Xi. Like, China is not a friend or ally to the United States. And he really, you know, kind of comes at this very big issue with sort of a personal diplomacy end to it. And of course, we know Xi does not really share that same level of diplomatic relations or diplomatic personality, I'll say.
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram and Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. You can hear more of our discussion on sources and methods wherever you get your podcasts.
Time now for the Healthcare Helpline, where we tackle your questions about navigating the health system. Millions of Americans face a possible steep rise in premiums in the coming year since Congress has not agreed to extend support for Affordable Care Act subsidies. But dealing with healthcare cost uncertainty is already a concern for many patients. And today, we're going to hear from Amber Wingler from Columbia, Missouri. Earlier this year, she learned that her insurance would not pay for her family to see their regular doctor anymore. Those doctors were no longer in network. So Wingler was at a loss. Could they do anything to keep their doctors?
So for a family of five, where do we even start?
Okay, well, we put that question to reporter Bram Sable-Smith. He's with our partner KFF Health News. Hi, Bram.
Hi, Elsa.
And just remind us, what is an insurance network anyway?
So an insurance network is the list of hospitals and doctors that your insurance company has a contract with. For doctors who are in network, insurance typically pays at least part of the cost.
That's right. Okay, so do we know why Wingler's doctors were no longer in the network anymore? Like, what happened?
Well, the contract between her family's doctors and insurer was expiring, and the two sides were haggling over a new deal.
We got a letter back in December that said that negotiations weren't going well.
It was a warning letter from her hospital letting her know her doctors might get dropped out of network. But Wingler tossed that letter in a paper shredder, which I found relatable. Hospitals insurers send these kinds of warnings all the time. They're kind of like tornado sirens. Most of the time, nothing happens, and Wingler knew that.
I'd expected that they would resolve their issues and sign the contracts.
But they didn't. And the timing was awful. Wingler's 8-year-old daughter, Cora, has been having troubles with her gut that they just can't figure out. So Wingler's been trying to book pediatric specialists to get a diagnosis.
And of course, then all of a sudden, we were out of network and we hadn't looked at our plan before to figure out that we would have to pay 100% out of pocket.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That I'm sure would add up really fast. Was paying out of pocket Wingler's only option at that point?
So I asked that question to Caitlin Donovan. She's with the Patient Advocate Foundation. It's a nonprofit that helps people having trouble accessing health care. She says the good news is if you have an emergency, you cannot be charged more than your in-network rates. The bad news is for most other things, you can.
There's that like old African proverb that when two elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. And unfortunately, in these situations, oftentimes patients are the grass. Mm.
But some people with serious or complex conditions do also have an option to ask for an extension of in-network coverage. It is a long process, though, with a lot of paperwork. Wingler ran that gauntlet for her daughter. She spent hours on the phone, filled out forms, sent faxes.
Faxes? Wait, who has a fax machine anymore?
Not me.
Me neither.
She went through that process, Wingler delayed her daughter's appointments for months. It was exhausting. And remember, she was juggling health appointments for other family members as well.
my son was going through physical therapy, but I'm sorry, dude, like, just do your exercises that you already have. I'm not fighting to get you coverage too when I'm already fighting for your sister.
Sorry, dude. I mean, how common is this, Bram? Like, how worried should listeners be if they get some letters saying their hospital and insurer are fighting? Because you're right, that is like a tornado siren to most people.
I called a guy looking into this. His name is Jason Buxbaum. He's a health policy researcher at Brown University. And he found over 650 hospitals that had a public dispute with an insurer since 2021. Just under half of those spats resulted in a breakup.
But anecdotally, it seems like a majority of those hospital insurer breakups resolve within a month or two.
And that's what happened in Columbia, Missouri. 3 months after their contract expired, Wingers Hospital, an insurer, announced they'd reached a new deal. Her doctors were back in network.
Oh, that's nice. Happy ending for her. But what are other people supposed to do if all of this happens to them?
Well, everyone has a different approach. Some people put off their appointments. Other people keep them and pay out of pocket. If you do that, hold on to your receipts, because when new deals get announced, they're often backdated to cover the appointments people paid cash for.
Oh.
And another thing. When you're choosing a plan during open enrollment, pay a little more attention to your plan's out-of-network costs, not just the in-network ones.
That is Bram Sable-Smith with our partner KFF Health News. Thank you, Bram.
Thank you.
Healthcare Helpline wants to hear from you. Go to npr.org and send your questions or frustrations about navigating the healthcare system.
This year's World Series between the Toronto Blue Jays and the Los Angeles Dodgers, it's a real gift to baseball fans, and it keeps on giving.
Last night's game, the fifth game, was no exception. The Blue Jays beat the Dodgers 6-1.
But what stood out was the performance of rookie pitcher Trey Yesavage.
Ground ball to third, to second one, to first for two. You asked, he delivered.
Yesavage's outing, heard there on the Canadian broadcaster Sportsnet, was among the best ever by a rookie pitching in the World Series.
In seven innings, he struck out 12 batters, breaking the World Series record set by a rookie more than 75 years ago.
You don't see this kind of thing. A guy this young and this inexperienced doing this on this stage. This doesn't happen.
Adding another layer to the 22-year-old Cinderella story is his journey just this year. Yesavage started the season playing deep in the minor leagues in single A.
Over the course of the year, he rose up through, get this, four levels to reach the majors and pitch on the biggest stage in baseball.
At a press conference after the game, Yesavage reflected on his unlikely rise to the mound in the World Series.
Yeah, it's a crazy world, crazy world. Hollywood couldn't have made it this good, so... just being a part of this, I'm just very blessed.
After Yesavage's gem last night, the Blue Jays are now just one game away from winning the World Series, and it would be the first for Toronto since 1993. Game 6 is tomorrow night.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at five shows this week, Friday through Sunday, October 31st to November 2nd, in Baxter, Brainerd, Bemidji, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off with some Halloween shows, Scarlet Woods is playing Friday at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. She is a talented guitarist and singer-songwriter who mixes folk and jazz and specializes in seven-string jazz guitar. 6 p.m. this Friday at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. In Brainerd, Smokin' Joe is playing a Halloween show with Costume Party at Coco Moon, 7 p.m. He is a one-man band funk and rock musician who plays lead guitar for fellow Twin Cities rocker Allure. Smokin' Joe this Friday at Coco Moon in Brainerd. In Bemidji, indie rocker Foxbee is playing a spooky Halloween show at Bridget's Irish Pub. The Mosey Palisari-led project have recently been in the studio working on a new album. It's Friday night, 9 p.m. in Bemidji. Even later on Halloween, the Pines Restaurant in Grand Rapids is hosting a dance party with yours truly DJing. It runs from 10 p.m. to 1 in the morning. Costumes are encouraged, and I'll be spinning a spooky mix of funk, soul, and disco records. Late night at the Pines in Grand Rapids. Finally, there are two chances to see jazz band the Mississippi Hot Club, Saturday in Bemidji and Sunday in Grand Rapids.
Now based in the Twin Cities, the group has strong ties to northern Minnesota and are deeply inspired by Django Reinhardt and Sam Miltich. Saturday, they are playing Bridget's Irish Pub at 6 p.m. and Sunday at the Rife Center's Cozy Concert Series in Grand Rapids at 2 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXC KBXC. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support for KAXC comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo. Serving the area since 1916, more at AtchisonTire.com. And weather tonight, chance of rain, cloudy with temps in the low to mid-30s.
And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Planet Money team is getting into the board game business because some of the most popular board games are all about economics. Think Monopoly and Settlers of Catan. But as Erica Barris and Kenny Malone from the Planet Money podcast find out, making a game that is fun and teaches economics is, well, it's kind of hard.
We started our game journey at Gen Con.
The crowd is surging. Is it open yet?
Hopefully.
Gen Con in Indianapolis is the country's largest tabletop gaming convention. There are a lot of gamers here, and there are a lot of new games entering the market.
Every year, about 5,000 new games come out from big companies like Hasbro and from small indie game makers like Leonie Grundler.
Would you like to tell me about Biome?
Yeah. This is a nature-themed tableau builder where you are trying to build a biodiverse ecosystem of plants and animals.
Leonie is the founder and CEO of Lioness Games. Biome is the first game she's made. She funded it on Kickstarter.
Tabletop games is actually the largest category on Kickstarter, which is so...
Get out of here.
Yeah,
really?
It is. It's so cool.
More than 57,000 game-related projects have been launched on Kickstarter.
We're first-time game makers, and Kickstarter could work for us, but we don't know anything about designing, manufacturing, or distributing a game, so we told Leonie that we were opting for a kind of shortcut, maybe.
Is it cheating if Planet Money, if we could link up with, like, a bigger producer or a partner who's had more experience doing this kind of thing?
Not at all.
It's okay.
It's okay. It's great.
We're not selling out.
No, you're not selling out. You know, you'll... With your audience and network, you'll get more people excited to play your game, hopefully. And then, so you're just by bringing more people to the hobby, you're, you know, helping everyone out.
So we ended up with a partner that once set a record on Kickstarter for raising $8.8 million for a game, Exploding Kittens. The company has since made dozens of other games.
We tell them our goal, that we want to make a fun game about economics. And the company's co-creator, Elon Lee, says, okay, but the thing he's concerned about is much more basic. He's thinking about something called a core mechanic.
So every game you have ever played has a core mechanic in it somewhere. It's sometimes called a board game loop or a game loop, things like that. It's the repetitive thing that you do over and over again that drives you from the beginning of the game to the end of the game. Hopefully, it escalates and you get better at it the more you do it.
The best games have a good core mechanic, but coming up with that core mechanic is not easy.
The worst game ever invented is Candyland.
Take that, children.
The reason that I pick on that game a lot is Candyland is... get to the end of this path, right? And the way you get to the end of this path is you draw cards and the cards tell you how to move. There is no faculty there, right? There's no decision-making. There's no mastery. There's no interaction. You might as well not be in the room. And so why are you bothering to have that experience?
Elon says we need to come up with a core mechanic that is fun and novel.
And so after nearly a year of trial and error and many, many, many versions, we did it. We have a fun new core mechanic, and we actually have a prototype of a game. You can download it, play it, and send us feedback. It's at planetmoneygame.com. Erica Barris,
Kenny Malone, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward.
Just like those inflatable jack-o'-lanterns, Spirit Halloween stores have popped up across the country. There are about 1,400 locations each year selling fake blood, fog machines, and lots of costumes. Well, two Princeton University student journalists took a closer look at their local shop last year.
At the Quaker Bridge Mall in Lawrence Township, New Jersey, the parking lot is full. But people aren't going to the main entrance.
They're headed for the pop-up shop at one end of the parking lot, with posters of little girls dressed like killer clowns, boys dressed up as inflatable expletives, and vivacious young women wearing nurse costumes.
We're talking about Spirit Halloween. Every day here is October 31st.
Isabel Jacobson and Adam Sanders hosted this podcast. It was a finalist in NPR's College Podcast Contest, and we figured Halloween is a perfect time to share a bit of their story.
The animatronic decorations for sale stretch out skeletal hands with conspicuous price tags. It's undead, unreal, a world that only exists until November 3rd.
Wonder how long it takes me to take down the store?
How long?
3 days.
3 days.
That's Debbie, one of the higher-ups at this Spirit Halloween. She's got long pink-dyed hair, thick glasses, and wears a t-shirt that in the top left corner says Spirit Halloween 2021. She's a veteran.
My husband spends way too much money on Spirit Halloween. And
really?
The only reason I put it in the application was for a 30% discount, to be honest.
Now, Debbie runs multiple Spirit Halloweens across central New Jersey. She deals with costume shipments from Spencer's Corporate, who owns the chain, as well as setting up elaborate decorations and hiring teams of Halloween fanatics. For Debbie, it's a great gig. The store is basically one big haunted house, with the caveat that they're trying to sell you a polyester Minions costume and some plastic skulls along the way. Anthony, a cashier, told us this experiential aspect of the store was a big part of his attraction to working there.
People come in, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're laughing, they're scared, they're having a good time, they're watching their friends get scared, their children get scared. I think the most part, we just want it to be an experience.
Spirit Halloween is a silly place. Nothing you buy here is gonna last.
Not even the stores last. They're open for only a few months at a time before returning to their hibernation. You can make the argument that with all of the fun of the decorations or the giddiness of picking out a costume, Spirit Halloween is in the end a store in a mall that sells you plastic.
But what surprised us about spending an afternoon at the Spirit Halloween in Lawrence Township was how deeply anti-materialist it felt to speak to the employees, who come back to the store season after season to sell costumes and candy and decorations. On Halloween, they said, you celebrate expression, choosing your own identity, reveling in the shocking or the transgressive or the fun. You make a statement about who you are.
It's the only holiday that you don't have to give anybody anything. It's all about you, if you want it to be, you know what I mean?
So it's always fun, you know. I mean, it's still a job, but it's fun, and it's, I can't complain. It's probably one of the better jobs I've ever had.
This has been Izzy Jacobson.
And Adam Sanders.
Have a wonderful evening, and once again, thank you for choosing Spirit Halloween for all of your Halloween needs.
And we should note, as this is a student podcast, it does something we generally do not do here at NPR. It identifies people by first name only.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota, with musical trio Kay Lee, now through November 5th. Find a full list of dates, times, and locations at alslib.info. Itasca County Family YMCA has their 44th annual fall auction and social Saturday, November 1st at 5:30 at Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids. Find more details and view the auction at ymcaitasca.org. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Brainerd Community Theater presents Dracula, a comedy of terrors, now through November 1st at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find more information at clcperformingarts.com. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. The Itasca Curling Association in Grand Rapids offers lessons, youth programming, league play, and more. Find information about upcoming events at itascacurling.com. And United Way of 1000 Lakes presents Dining United now through November 20th. Find a list of participating Itasca County restaurants at uwlakes.org.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Governor Tim Walz announced Wednesday that his administration will pause payments for more than a dozen Medicaid services pending a third-party audit. The Department of Human Services flagged 14 Medicaid services as high risk based on what it calls program vulnerabilities and evidence of fraudulent activity. The funding pause could last up to 90 days for programs like integrated community supports, non-emergency medical transportation, adult day services, and many other programs serving people with disabilities. The audit will be performed by Optum, a division of Minnesota-based United Health Group. Earlier this year, national media outlets reported the healthcare giant was also under investigation for fraud by the Department of Justice. Walz, who recently announced his intention to seek a third term in office, stated that programs and services can't be effectively delivered without the backing of public trust. The now-defunct Housing Stabilization Services is among the 14 programs affected by the pause. The state moved to shut down the program in August due to fraud, with 8 people currently charged in federal court. The payment pause comes amid a fraud frenzy in Minnesota that so far appears to have cheated the state out of hundreds of millions of dollars. Minnesota's largest nurses union is calling out Essentia Health for what it describes as unsafe staffing levels following 4 recent assaults on staff in Duluth and Brainerd. The Minnesota Nurses Association says the incidents over a 2-week time span reflect a, quote, dangerous pattern in Essentia facilities, one that nurses have been warning about for years. The union is calling for strengthened staffing ratios and including frontline nurses in hospital safety decisions. In a statement to the Minnesota Star Tribune, Essentia Health says the union is, quote, exploiting a serious challenge to score points in the press instead of working toward meaningful solutions, and that, quote, no amount of staffing can prevent violence against healthcare workers. MNA says security systems and emergency tools play an essential role in hospital safety, but can't replace the need for adequate nursing staff to prevent crises before they occur. The Star Tribune reports that between 2021 and 2022, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports there were 550 assaults in Minnesota hospitals that resulted in workers missing days or having restricted duty transfers because of their injuries. Pretty soon, Minnesota's farm fields will be in a deep freeze, but some seeds will still be doing their work. Farmers trying out a winter-hardy crop are at the forefront of a production process to create cleaner fuel for commercial jets. This fall, the University of Minnesota's Forever Green Initiative is in the early stages of a study to determine the next steps for sustainable aviation fuel. A key ingredient is winter camelina, a cover crop that not only protects the soil from erosion, but also has the potential for commercial use. Forever Green's co-director Mitch Hunter says right now they're green rows of little plants that will fully blossom in the spring.
And then after the plant flowers, those flowers will turn into fruit packed with seeds. And inside each one of those seeds, you have 35% or so oil.
Minnesota researchers and their partners are leading a charge to convert that seed oil into low-carbon jet fuel that airlines can use to reduce their emissions. Last fall, a test flight using SAF flew out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Hunter says the latest research aims to lay out a blueprint detailing what's needed to scale up production. Challenges include perfecting crop varieties and finding enough processing capacity. In northern Minnesota, fourth-generation farmer Eric Kakowski just planted his share of winter camelina across roughly 640 acres. It's his third season of trying this crop out. Like researchers, there's a learning curve for him, including the best time in the fall for putting the seeds in the ground. But he says it's an easy crop to manage.
I don't have to babysit it. I can take care of my other crops and make sure they're producing like they're supposed to.
Groups like Friends of the Mississippi River back the movement because of the chance to improve water quality with healthier farmland. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for the story. ESCO finished fourth place in the girls' soccer state tournament. They tied with St. Cloud Cathedral with 0 points in the third place match Thursday afternoon. ESCO played top-seeded Providence Academy and lost 1-3 in the semifinals Wednesday. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
What might the president mean by that? Let's bring in NPR science and security correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Hi.
Hi there.
So, Jeff, the president said, if they're going to test, I guess we have to test. So I guess my question is, who's they?
Yeah, it wasn't entirely clear from what he said, but experts I spoke to today agree it's almost certainly Russia. On Sunday, Russia announced it successfully tested a nuclear-powered cruise missile. Then yesterday, it said it had tested a nuclear-powered torpedo. Now, nuclear-powered things obviously aren't the same as nuclear bombs, but both the missile and torpedo are designed to carry nuclear warheads. And these tests are very provocative because these devices could get around Trump's proposed Golden Dome missile defense system.
Okay, so if the U.S. were to test a nuclear weapon, let's say, what would be involved?
Well, first of all, there's only one place they can do it, and that's in the desert outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a place called the Nevada National Security Site. It's absolutely massive. I was out there last year. It's bigger than the state of Rhode Island. Huh. Basically, they dig a hole, bury the weapon thousands of feet underground, and then they detonate it. Corey Hinderstein is at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And until last year, she was high up in the agency that manages America's nuclear weapons. She told me this.
The president is talking about sending a signal. And if the goal is to shake the ground, then we could do it on the timeline that he's required.
But the test site is not ready to do a really scientific test. They don't have the experiment design. They don't have the instrumentation. That kind of test would take years to develop because the U.S. hasn't tested since 1992.
Well, why has it been so long since the U.S. tested a nuclear weapon?
At the end of the Cold War, the world's great nuclear powers voluntarily stopped testing, kind of as a gesture of goodwill. That voluntary moratorium has held in part because the U.S. has spent billions of dollars on supercomputers to simulate nuclear weapons. They like to call it a bang in a box. And actually, many experts told me the moratorium works to the U.S.'s advantage. They have data from over 1,000 nuclear tests already on the books. China, by contrast, for example, has just 45. Hinderstein says America's adversaries would gain a lot more from additional testing than the U.S. would.
While we could potentially gain incrementally, but even that is questionable, they could stand to gain a lot and not suffer the political hit by being the first to resume testing.
I should add, there are possible environmental consequences, too. Radioactive material can leak from underground sometimes. And there's some concern that shaking from the test could actually damage buildings all the way in Vegas.
So, Jeff, the Russians have tested these new weapons, and America may test a nuclear bomb for the first time in decades. So I do have to ask, is this a new arms race?
You know, the experts I spoke to were divided on that. During the Cold War, we had so many nukes, and so did the Russia. It was sort of insane. Now, things aren't as bad as they used to be, but everyone agrees these are the dynamics that drive an arms race. You know, one side does one thing and then the other side says, I've got to look strong, so I'm going to respond with something else. So there's a lot of concern over what's happening.
NPR's Jeff Brumfield, thank you.
Thank you.
Since the pandemic, car insurance premiums have risen twice as fast as inflation overall. The NPR series Cost of Living, The Price We Pay, has been looking at how people are coping with inflation. And today, NPR's Camila Domonoske digs into car insurance, which is a line item that's required for American drivers.
Zoe is a pastry chef in Pennsylvania. We're only using her first name because she briefly drove without insurance, which is technically illegal. And let's just be clear, Zoe understands the importance of car insurance. A few years ago, she had the bare minimum insurance on her car, and an accident financially devastated her.
The mental anguish and the $7,000.
Her Toyota was undrivable, and it was hard to be carless with an hour-long commute.
Have you ever tried to take a Lyft from the suburbs of Philadelphia to Wilmington, Delaware?
That's an expensive ride. The accident wiped out her savings. So when she was able to replace her damaged Toyota, she made sure to get full coverage insurance.
It's about $230 a month.
She could pay it, barely. Until her rent went up by $400 a month.
I fully didn't pay my car insurance bill for about 4 weeks just because I couldn't afford it. Like, we have to eat every week, pay the power and the water bill, and the rent keeps going higher, and milk's $4 a gallon.
But she had to keep working, so she had to keep driving. Driving without insurance is against the law in almost every state. It's risky and it's expensive because you pay extra to restart insurance. Zoe has since scraped together the funds to get her car insurance back. But she was far from alone. From 2018 to 2023, the percentage of motorists driving without insurance rose from 12% to 15%, according to the Insurance Research Council. Bob Passmore, who's with the trade group that speaks for the big insurers, says the increase in uninsured drivers is not exactly mysterious.
That tends to go with the cost of insurance.
Higher premiums are just harder to pay, and premiums have soared. Passmore points to the rising costs of medical bills and car repairs. Plus, empty streets during COVID led to more speeding and more severe crashes. That's all expensive for insurance companies, he says.
If their prices aren't keeping up with the cost of claims, then they're losing money and they're not going to be able to continue operating.
So companies raised premiums. And last year, their profits were good. Passmore says the industry needs good years to cover for bad ones. Meanwhile, tariffs are pushing up the prices for metal and car parts, making repairs even more expensive, which could be felt in future premiums. In a recent survey, more than half of drivers told LendingTree they've cut back elsewhere to pay for car insurance. That's the first thing Brandy Levine did. Last year, her 2018 Acura cost $500 a month to insure.
I had one speeding ticket on there. I don't have any accidents.
So she cut back on travel. No more trips with her kids out of town. They live in Yakima, Washington. Then Levine shopped around and found a cheaper plan. Insurance experts told NPR that's their top recommendation for coping with these rising costs. Meanwhile, more than a third of drivers also told LendingTree they avoid filing claims to keep their premiums lower. That's frustrating in its own way, as Levine puts it.
I'm not benefiting anything from it because I don't ever file a claim.
Levine has one more strategy for keeping her insurance costs down. Her 17-year-old son, Josiah, just got his license, but
I went through the process to see what it would cost to Adam, and they told me it would be $350 a month. And I'm like, oh, I can't do this. Like, that's so much money.
Levine would like it if Josiah could drive himself to school. And Josiah, he'd love to have a set of keys.
Just to go somewhere outside of Yakima, like, just not being in this cycle where I'm just stuck in this town, stuck with the same life, stuck in the same living situation.
But until he gets a job to pay that insurance bill himself, stuck is exactly what he is. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Low-income families across the country rely on Head Start for childcare and preschool, but federal funding for the program is on hold during the government shutdown, and now some 65,000 children are at risk of losing their Head Start services. NPR's Caden Mills has the story.
In Florida, a cluster of Head Start programs serve the children of migrant and seasonal farm workers.
I was a former migrant worker, was a Head Start child, migrant Head Start child.
Daniel Jaime runs six Head Start programs across a handful of counties as a part of the East Coast Migrant Head Start Project.
But I still consider myself a migrant farm worker because I still every now and then go out and pick muscadine grapes and blueberries here when in season.
In any given year, Jaime centers serve around 500 children. Without federal funding, those centers will be forced to shut down. That could keep many farm workers at home caring for children.
It's just a full circle from, you know, not having the services for these children, for growers not having their workers there, and also maybe loss of production. If they don't have the manpower, then what do they do?
He worries that to keep working the fall harvest, some may have no choice but to leave their children in less than ideal settings.
That's the biggest thing for me right now is knowing that we have our babies out there and we can't serve them in the center.
Without federal funding, Jaime's Head Start programs will shut down after Friday. And his centers aren't alone. According to the National Head Start Association, 134 Head Start programs across the country have funding cycles that start on November 1st. And that funding can't be renewed while the government is shut down.
They are scrambling and trying to figure out how long they can keep the doors open.
Tommy Sheridan is with the National Head Start Association. He says programs are looking into anything that might help them stay open for just a little longer, including delaying rent and utility bills and trying to raise emergency funding.
They're talking to schools. They're talking to their state. They're talking to philanthropic partners, their banks, about lines of credit.
Some programs have a built-in advantage. They're in the minority of states that also spend their own money to help fund the centers. Sue Linsmeyer runs a Head Start center in Northern Oregon, where she says the state provides about 60% of their funding.
If we didn't have state dollars, that would be a whole different story. I don't even know what we would do. We would probably have to shut down.
Still, Linsmeyer says the program can only avoid closure for so long without federal dollars. But she hopes it doesn't come to that. To do this kind of work, she says you have to be hopeful.
And we just hired a woman named Hope, and I said, thank goodness you're here!
Linsmeyer has 314 children in her program right now, or as she says, 314 more opportunities to change a life for the better. Caden Mills, NPR News.
This year will be the 75th year where kids in costumes go door to door to collect not just candy, but also small change. That's right, donations for UNICEF, the United Nations Agency for Children. Trick or Treat for UNICEF actually began a decade before the U.S. Agency for International Development was established. It now appears to have outlived USAID. We'll have the story of children helping children for 75 years on tomorrow's All Things Considered. If you aren't by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, now offering their winter market once a month with pickup at the Mesabi Trailhead Building inside the Itasca County Fairgrounds. The next pickup date is Saturday, November 22nd from 1 to 2 p.m. Pre-orders are required with more info at grfarmersmarket.org. Weather tonight, chance of rain, cloudy with temps in the low to mid-30s. Tomorrow, slight chance of rain, possible snow in northwest Minnesota.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. The psychologist Colton Scrivener just loves this time of year.
Everything I do is kind of surrounded by the Halloween spirit, if you will, right? My research is on horror movies and true crime and people who sort of are interested in the macabre. And I organize events that are like a horror film festival and a zombie crawl.
That's right, a zombie crawl, which happens every year where Scrivener lives in Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
Everyone dresses up as any kind of creative zombie that you could possibly imagine. And then they kind of go through the town and there's a gelatin brain-eating contest. And
yummy.
Yeah, and then a big parade where the zombies are kind of all in the front. And then the
Eureka Springs also happens to be home to a famously haunted hotel called the Crescent. So his town sort of is the perfect home for a psychologist who studies the spooky and the scary. Scrivener has a new book about all that called Morbidly Curious. A scientist explains why we can't look away. And I asked him to start by telling me exactly how he defines morbid curiosity.
Morbid curiosity is just an interest in or curiosity about things that are potentially dangerous. So the morbid descriptor doesn't mean the curiosity is bad.
Right.
It just means that the thing you are interested in is dangerous.
Got it. Like potentially
serial killers or environmental disasters,
ghosts.
Or ghosts, or yeah, bodily injuries, any kind of thing that gives you information about something you wouldn't want to be exposed to.
Right. And you argue in this book that morbid curiosity is a healthy part of human nature, right?
Yeah, it can be, yes.
How so?
Well, you know, historically it helped not just humans, but really any animal that is subject to dangers in their environment, which is every animal, right? Nature is a very scary place. It helped them survive because in order to effectively avoid dangers in your local environment, you need to know something about them, right? That's how you learn how to avoid them, learn how to circumvent them. And in humans, we have a very particular kind of morbid curiosity because we have stories and we have transmissible culture. So we can remove almost all of the costs of learning about something dangerous because in nature, it's very dangerous to learn about something dangerous.
You know, right.
If you're
to
a zebra.
Approach the predator.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a cost with that. With humans, we can kind of remove all of the costs, and it makes us the most morbidly curious creatures of all.
Okay. I want to talk about the paranormal because you talk about it in this book. You have even gone on a paranormal hunt of sorts at some old haunted mansion in Savannah, Georgia. And what I want to ask you is you say that you don't believe in ghosts. So why even go on a hunt like this? Like, why entertain something that you as a scientist don't even buy?
Well, I mean, a good scientist should be willing to change their mind if they're presented with evidence.
Okay.
You know, it would take quite a bit of shifting in my worldview for that to happen, but I'm open to it as a scientist. If I, you know, had the evidence, I'm open to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen things that are difficult to explain. So in this hotel in Eureka Springs, the Crescent, I was there on an overnight ghost hunt one time, and we had these two little plastic cat toys, like little plastic balls with red button on top, and you push the button and when the cat hits it, it lights up, right?
Okay.
So we put these two balls on a bed in the supposedly most haunted room in the hotel.
Uh-huh.
And then we kind of shook the bed to see how much would it take to get them to light up? Like how much movement does it take? And it took quite a bit. We really had to like kind of shake the bed.
Okay.
And then one of the paranormal investigators I was there with said, you know, we've heard that this room, there's a spirit in this room. So we have these two balls here. The one on the left, we want you to use that for yes. And the one on the right, we want you to use that for no.
Oh my God, you made a Ouija board out of two balls.
We made a Ouija board with cat toys, yes.
Oh my God.
And so the investigator said, we've heard that the ghost in this room is named Michael. If that's true, would you light up the yes ball? And there was like one beat, and the yes ball lit up without anybody moving.
Holy!
And then nothing else happened the rest of the night. That was the first thing we did.
That's
the
a
first
significant thing.
But it was a significant
Colton
thing.
Colton Scrivener, how can you not believe in ghosts after that?
So my body got chills, right? I did.
Sure.
I got goosebumps. You know, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I didn't
physiologically,
have,
your body was on high alert.
Yes. And I went in. Obviously, I wasn't skeptical, but not cynical, right? I was there to have fun, and nobody moved. It was dead silent, and there was just that 1 second beat, and then the yes ball lit up. And I don't have an explanation for that one.
And yet you refuse to believe in ghosts.
Well, it's not that I refuse to believe. It's that, you know, in science, you have these empirical findings that
sure.
add up to create a theory,
sure.
right?
Sure, and you need more findings.
Well, in order to create what's called like a paradigm shift into a new way that that you understand the world. You got to have a lot of those findings that you can then tie together with string, like a detective in a movie, you know?
Okay, so keep ghost hunting.
So keep ghost hunting,
All right. So you point out in this book that there is a rise in true crime as a genre. Like, there's more interest in it. We see it in books. We see it in podcasts, TV shows, et cetera. Why do you think that is? Like, what does that rise in interest in true crime tell us about humans or how society is changing? Does it tell us much?
Yeah. So we live in a world now where I live in a small town, so I know almost all of my neighbors, right? But I've lived in bigger cities. I lived in Chicago for 6 years. I didn't know the people who were next to me. So you don't know much about the people around you in our more modern society. And, you know, the world is pretty divisive right now. It's been more divisive, I think, in the past 5 to 10 years than it's ever been. And I think that leads us to be suspicious of people and suspicious of their motives, suspicious of conspiracies, suspicious of people who might be plotting or planning something. And that triggers in us an interest in learning about the kinds of people who do that. And so you're also seeing a rise not just in true crime, like murder documentaries, but sort of conspiracy documentaries or people who maybe did something bad, but it wasn't violently bad. It was bad in another kind of way. They schemed someone or they conned someone. And we're kind of more interested broadly in these people who are potentially planning or plotting to do something that would harm us in one way or another.
Gosh, now I'm thinking our rise in interest in true crime is just a symptom of a more divided, isolated, siloed society.
It could be.
That's not a good sign, Colton.
That's not a good sign. Fortunately, I think you know, the interest in true crime itself and consuming it, you know, doesn't seem to be associated with anything bad. It's more of just, like you said, a consequence of what's going on, maybe.
Okay. So it's almost Halloween now. What happens at the Scrivener House on Halloween? My imagination's going wild now.
Yeah.
What happens in Eureka Springs at the Scrivener House?
Yeah, so Eureka Springs loves Halloween. And so last year, we bought 2,000 pieces of candy. I live in a town of 2,000 people, okay? So it's important to keep that in mind. We bought 2,000 pieces of candy and made sure kids only took 2 pieces when they came. And we ran out by like... We ran out by like 5 p.m. It wasn't even dark yet.
That's a lot of kids.
It's a lot of kids. So everybody comes in because it's a very, you know, old, spooky Victorian town. A lot of the houses are these big Victorian houses and everybody, you know, goes all out. We have a couple of 12-foot skeletons and we live on a dead-end road and we have a skeleton up on the dead-end sign, you know.
Looking very dead.
Exactly. And so, yeah, this year we bought like 4,000 pieces of candy. We tried to double it to try to
get to 7 p.m.
We'll get maybe to dusk at least. Yeah.
That sounds like a good time.
Yes.
Colton Scrivener is the author of a new book called Morbidly Curious, A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. Thank you so much for coming into NPR West today. This was so much fun.
It was a blast. Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features with Begonia. Two conspiracy-obsessed young men kidnap the CEO of a company, convinced that she is an alien intent on destroying Earth, now playing in select theaters everywhere tomorrow. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Upbrain Translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Everyone is invited to the Bemidji Halloween Skate on Friday, October 31st, beginning at 5 p.m., meet at the Bangsburg parking lot on the BSU campus and bike, skate, or roll down Beltrami Avenue. Costumes encouraged, and families may peel off the route at any time to continue trick-or-treating. Weather tonight, partly cloudy skies with lows 24 to 28. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the low to mid-50s, overnight lows in the upper 30s, low 40s.